there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, discussion, healthcare, and science, all rolled into one big free form. Well, it's kind of a laboratory, a learning laboratory, and you get to participate. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers. It doesn't necessarily represent the opinions of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. We're heading into the Christmas season with lots of various things out there to consider for gift giving. Let's make it a healthy Christmas season this year. If you attend a party or imbibe in an alcoholic beverage, don't drive. Have a designated driver. Take turns. Let's keep our roads safe. Every year we have an upsurge in traffic-related deaths related to drunk driving. It's a serious public health issue. Do your part. If you think a friend shouldn't drive, get in their face and stop them. Lots of interesting things in the news this week, but I think the top story, probably ironically, is an announcement from the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. After careful research, they've determined that calorie restriction improves diabetes. They have proof in terms of both MRI studies of fat around the heart shrinking when you put people on a reduced calorie diet, and there was a striking improvement in blood sugar. Well, I'm sure glad to know that, and if you hear me being a little sarcastic, well, that's because I fail to see why anyone would think that you needed a scientific study to establish that calorie restriction improves diabetes. Nevertheless, there it is, proof positive that science marches on. We have our first caller, and I think let's jump to the phones. It's Sandy in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sandy. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
I'm good. I hear you have a recipe for us.
Yeah. I went to a potluck last night, and I realized that we're in December now. We're in the throes of holiday parties, and I wanted to share this recipe, or this, I have a salad recipe. It's spinach salad with citrus fruit. But what was most amazing was the dressing. It was just a very simple dressing with fruit juices and a balsamic vinegar. And the point was is that it was about presentation, and people love the way that it was presented. You know, and I had a nice platter of soup, and I had the dressing on it. And I just wanted to be able to give people some more, you know, ideas like this. And so if they wanted to, I don't know, is the best way just to email me? I can email them the recipe.
Okay. This is the Sandy who does the cooking for cancer, right?
Or are you cooking for cancer prevention and diabetes prevention, yes.
Right. So what's your website? I'll let people actually give it out, and people can call and get the recipe. Do you have other recipes up on your website?
Yeah, I have recipes on my website, but the best way to get this one would just be to simplynutritious@gmail.com.
All right, Sandy. Thanks very much, and happy holidays.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
And let's go to an email. This one I thought was pretty good. This is anonymous in Los Gatos. Dear Dr. Dawn, love your program. I woke up yesterday with a pain in the big toe joint of one foot, no redness or swelling, and a slightly raised and pink rash around my mouth. The rash doesn't itch, but it's irritated. No apparent rash inside my mouth, and the toe pain went away during the day but was back this morning. Rash seems a bit more pronounced this morning. I had my teeth cleaned 2 days ago, but otherwise nothing apparently different. I eat a good diet, little red meat, lots of vegetables, and have lost 17 pounds over the last 7 months, so should I be concerned about these symptoms? Well, the big toe joint concerns me a little bit because that's the joint where gout is so common, and so I'm wondering if you might be walking down that path or starting to walk down that path. Sounds like your diet's very good, but sometimes people can consume a lot of something that contains a purine without realizing it, although those are generally meat dishes. I'm not sure about your toe joint. The rash around your mouth definitely makes me think about mangoes, and eating mangoes off the skin is a common way that people get a perioral rash. And again, it is possible that you had a reaction to having your tooth cleaned, either the substances that they used for polishing or, and this would be bad, latex. And the last thought is, have you changed lipstick or makeup lately? So thinking about all of those things, but in the short run, you can use a little bit of 1% hydrocortisone ointment. Try to get the ointment, not the cream, and rub that in for about 30 seconds around your lips, and that will really help reduce the redness. Should the symptoms become more aggravated or persist, obviously you'll need to seek medical attention. And the comment that Anonymous made about red meat, I just wanted to share with you a study that was just done looking at red meat and prostate cancer. And this was a retrospective study. It was published in the online journal PLOS1, and it was looking at the type of meat that men ate and their risk of prostate cancer. This study confirms and supports previous studies showing that risk of prostate cancer is correlated with how much red meat you eat, and particularly processed meats containing nitrates and meats that were grilled or barbecued. So that barbecued ballpark frank is just about a recipe for the worst possible food to eat if you're seeking to reduce your risk of prostate cancer. Sorry, guys, but maybe take something else out to the ball game. This email from David in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I've had some form of chronic rhinitis for decades. It's been treated as an allergy for years, but that doesn't really seem to help. I tried Chinese herbs with some positive effect, but eventually it returns and continues to be a problem. The worst of it is that my nose becomes so congested while sleeping that I wake after about 5 hours and can't continue to sleep until I've blown my nose for several minutes. And of course, after that, getting back to sleep is rarely possible. If you have any insights on this, I would really appreciate it. Well, David, I'm thinking dust mites. The fact that you get worse at night suggests that there's something in perhaps very close proximity to your face, like your pillow or your mattress, that could be triggering this. It is true that we do get more nasal congestion at night, sometimes just as a physiologic effect because our head is lower and so there's increased blood flow to the nose. But I would suggest that you get the dust mite proof covers, put those on your mattress and your pillows, wash all of your bedding, including your blankets, in hot water once a week. And you might try also a couple of products. One of them is available without prescription. It's called Nasochrome. It's chromium sodium. And if you squirted that in your nose at dinner time and then again at bedtime, you might reduce the reactivity of the mast cells. That compound, by the way, is better if it's used on a regular basis. So I would use it maybe 3 times a day, targeted towards the evening hours. Do that for a week before you give up on the idea. And another product, a prescription product, is a non-decongestant decongestant. In other words, it doesn't stimulate the sympathetic nerve endings, which would be a decongestant. It inhibits the atropinic nerve endings, so it's a sort of inverse decongestant. The good thing about Atrovent nasal is that it does not cause rebound symptoms when you stop using it. It's the drug that I use for my chronic rhinitis patients because it isn't specific for allergies, and some people just have a chronic rhinitis from overreactive blood vessels in the nose. And as I said, because it doesn't cause a rebound, I'll even use it in people who are having a real problem with congestion from a cold. I don't like to use the nasal decongestants because they can raise blood pressure and heart rate. And also, as I said, because people can become addicted to them and they're just really, really difficult to get off of. Off-air suggestion for the guy with night breathing problems. I like the Breathe Right strips and the extra variety, which hold the nasal passage open by a spring-like action. That was for the fellow earlier who was having nasal congestion at night and needing to blow his nose. I suspect he was also having mucus, but the Breathe Right strips would certainly not be a bad idea and definitely something that is in the category of worth a try. One more email, this one from Kim in Boulder Creek. Can you speak to dietary and nutritional impacts on ankylosing spondylitis progression and symptoms such as joint pain and stiffness? My husband uses Imbrel intermittently once every 2 months when the pain is extreme. Otherwise, knowing that it inhibits immune system function, he generally doesn't use it. Well, first of all, ankylosing spondylitis, folks, is an autoimmune disease where the joints, particularly the joints of the spine, are inflamed and actually over time will tend to fuse together. That's the ankylosing part of ankylosing spondylitis. This is an autoimmune disease. It's associated with a particular DNA marker, an HLA called HLA-B27. And as I said, it's more common in men, but it does affect women as well, slightly different manifestations. There's a strong association between having an overgrowth of the bacteria Klebsiella in the intestines and flares of ankylosing spondylitis. It would seem that in some individuals, those who are HLA-B27 positive, there's something on the surface of that Klebsiella bacteria that looks enough like those people's joints that the immune system becomes confused and begins to attack the joints. The Klebsiella then remaining in the intestine acts to stimulate the whole process. So when I encounter a person with ankylosing spondylitis, I try and do what's called a gut restoration protocol, an aspect of functional medicine where we use either natural medicines or antibiotics to kind of kill off most of the gut flora and then reseed with large quantities of probiotic bacteria, kind of trying to reset things. And then periodically during flares, I'll re-clean the gut, so to speak, to try to get rid of any Klebsiella that might be adding to the flare. I do agree that Imbrel, this is a monoclonal antibody that reduces tumor necrosis alpha, does have a profound effect on the immune system. It can be great in the middle of a flare, and I think it's very useful. But I worry that regular use may let someone in for risks of actual tumors. It is, after all, called tumor necrosis factor because it kills tumors. Maybe we don't want to shut that particular aspect of the immune system down entirely or for long periods of time. Just a little precautionary principle thought on that. And one more quick story. Just out, the FDA has actually okayed the first umbilical cord blood product. Umbilical cord blood contains stem cells, hematopoietic progenitor cells, they're called. And you can use these as a bone marrow transplant. So it becomes similar to doing a bone marrow transplant. So you could treat acute leukemia in children and adults. And this product is a commercial product. Its name is Hemacord. And it's the first of these progenitor cell products that have become available. Presumably, it will have less issues with graft versus host disease than the use of adult bone marrow donor transplants. And nowadays, by the way, folks, in case you didn't know, you can become a bone marrow donor without having a large needle stuck into your hip. Bone marrow can be harvested from peripheral blood. And if you haven't signed up to be a donor, please do so. There are literally thousands of different bone marrow types. And so getting a donor match is much, much harder, actually, than getting an organ match. So it's really important that we all be willing to donate bone marrow, even more important than blood, really, because of the fact that you may be uniquely matched to some other person on the planet. You may be one of the few people who could save a life by simply lying down in a chair and sticking your arm out for an hour and watching a movie. Now, let me tell you, I've saved some lives in my time, but it was never that easy. So let's go to the phones, and we're going to be talking to Will in Scotts Valley. Hello, Will, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Bob.
Good morning. What can I do for you today?
My question concerns warfarin therapy for DVT in my lower left leg.
Yes.
Well, a friend of mine, a couple of days ago, I mentioned that I was on that, and he said, oh, I was on this, but my doctor switched me to some other drug, and I didn't get the name. It started with a P.
Pradaxa, probably.
Yeah, and he said, I don't have to have the blood draws or blood tests periodically.
Right. That's right. Okay, a couple questions for you. Will, you sound like you're over 65 from your voice.
Yeah, 90.
Okay. Well, number one, whether you should do this or not really depends on what other drugs you're on and what your Medicare Part D coverage is. Because the way this works out, Pradaxa's a new drug, so it's more expensive. And if it's covered on your Medicare Part D, your drug coverage, and you're not taking a lot of other expensive drugs so that you won't get to that, I think it's $2,400. And after you pass $2,400, you fall into the big hole and you have to pay for all your drugs until you spend $3,600. And then Medicare kicks in and pays for the rest of your drugs for the year. So you have to do the math and make sure before you switch to this that it's not going to put you into the donut hole in October and stick you with having to pay for all of your meds. And I don't know how many meds you're on. You're 90, so you're probably fairly healthy. But the average elder takes 5 prescription medications. I joke and I say it's 1 per decade by the time you're 70. But how many drugs are you on?
They're not costing me very much.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that they wouldn't if you fell into the donut hole. So it's complicated, complicated, complicated.
I wasn't so much concerned about that, but I mean, this is a new drug. Has it been, you know, it's not, I don't know how long it's been on testing.
Okay, so it's been through fairly good scrutiny through the FDA. I do not believe that it's been used that long in Europe. It's not one of those drugs that's been in Europe for 20 years that we're finally getting. So it's a relatively new agent. There are several other agents coming down the track for approval that may replace it. But the idea of these drugs is that these are factor 10A inhibitors. So they have a little bit different mechanism than Coumadin or warfarin. And they don't over-anticoagulate you, and they aren't as reactive to drugs and food. The problem with Coumadin is if you eat different diet each day, eat too many fruits and vegetables, it fights the drug and you don't get your anticoagulation. That's why we're always bringing people in and checking their blood and adjusting the dose. We're in the winter now, and so every week I have 4 or 5 people on Coumadin whose blood comes back and they're over-coagulated. They haven't changed their dose, but they're not eating as much fruit right now because it's winter and the fruit isn't so abundant. So we see this every year. And then in the summer around May, I have to put people's dose back up again because they start eating fruit and their Coumadin needs to be adjusted to account for the change in nutrition. And whenever you start someone an antibiotic, you have to check it. So it's an annoying drug and doctors are really thrilled to have something else. In terms of its ability to protect against stroke, it is as good or better, a little bit better or a little bit worse, but you know, more or less as good as Coumadin. It has maybe a slightly increased chance of causing GI bleeding, at least in some of the clinical trials that was seen, but it doesn't have any increased death rate. So it might cause more chance of GI bleeding, but it isn't severe GI bleeding. And it does have equivalence on strokes, and it may actually have superiority on heart disease, although that wasn't a primary endpoint for the studies. So we really won't know for sure until someone does that study, because the statistics can lie when you look at secondary endpoints, and I won't go into the technicalities of that. So all in all, it's more expensive, it's no less safe, and it's more convenient. The only drawback I really see to the Pradaxa, and it's an important drawback, is that it has a 12-hour half-life. Some of the newer other companies have a 24-hour half-life. I don't really like the idea of giving people a drug that only lasts 12 hours when I'm thinning their blood, because if it wears off at night, they may have a chance to form a blood clot overnight. So if I've got somebody who's good at taking drugs and I think is reliable at a twice-a-day agent, then I might consider giving them Pradaxa.
Oh, it has to be given twice a day.
Yeah, that's the rub.
And you still would have to have periodic blood tests, wouldn't you?
Just for checking for anemia, but you don't have to have your blood coagulation parameters checked.
He says he doesn't have to have it monthly.
No, that's what I'm saying. Once a year, maybe.
Oh, okay. He considers that a benefit.
Well, it's huge annoyance for people, especially if they have mobility issues, to get down for that blood draw.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's pretty cool. Well, what you have to do is, you know, go to the Gray Bears, because they have counselors and they can help you figure out, they can look at your drug plan and they can help you figure out whether it would get you into trouble to change.
Yeah.
Okay?
Thank you very
thank you.
Much.
Bye-bye. And there is actually, and I believe it is on my website. If it's not, it shall be so within a couple of days. But there is a link to a government service that helps people navigate all of the different health plans and find the Medicare Part D that would work the best for them given the medications that they take. As I said to our previous caller, sometimes it doesn't cost you much, but it may be a costly drug. It's just being underwritten by an insurance policy. Let's go to another email. Sibel in San Jose writes, I've written to you before about my alteration and recession of smell and taste, which I attribute to the spraying for a light brown apple moth when I started to smell something like diesel fumes immediately after the spray. Now, personally, I think this is a question for an ENT. I have this diesel smell that continues in my nose, but my PCP sent me to a neurologist who then ordered an MRI. Because I feel so bombarded on all sides from either chemicals sprayed from airplanes or other pollution, I'm really reluctant to have this dye injected. How safe is it really? I do not have any kidney problems. Nevertheless, I am just not quite sure about it. I understand the benefit-risk rationale. They also said they could probably see a brain tumor without the dye, but they would not be able to see the small nerves that could possibly be affected and responsible for my alteration and recession of taste and smell. If there's no other way around this, could I take a cleanse after the MRI? Thanks for your answer. Your show's my favorite. I had to read that last part. Okay, so the gadolinium dye that's used in a brain MRI is not, so far, not so bad. We've got 20 years of data. Whenever I do a metal scan and I look for heavy metal in the urine, I give someone a chelating agent to do that. I will see gadolinium. I could tell if they've ever had an MRI in their life, basically, by the fact that their gadolinium will go up. So it does remain in the body, but so far we've not really identified any problems with that. Stay tuned, but, you know, 20-year data is pretty good. An MRI is to rule out a brain tumor because you're seeing a neurologist, and a neurologist sort of has to rule out a brain tumor. And you've asked a question, what's wrong with my sense of smell, that theoretically, at least, a brain tumor could cause an alteration of your sense of smell and taste. And so he's doing the due diligence of his practice. As far as the small nerves are concerned, if you had something affecting the small nerves, what would you do about it? Nothing. If you had a brain tumor in that area, you might not do anything about it either, or maybe they'd go after it with a gamma knife. But basically, brain tumor is a real long shot. I would see if you can get your doctor to order an MSH test. This is melanocyte-stimulating hormone. It's available through LabCorp, and it is a test that shows a type of hypothalamic disorder that's associated with altered sense of smell. So now when I get this history in my functional medicine practice, I'm getting this test and finding that when this is elevated, I know that I have a hypothalamic issue and I don't have to chase down the brain tumor. So if that's high, I think you could skip the MRI. It's about $200. Your insurance may or may not pay for it, but it is a commercially available test and it does have a validated normal range. And if you're up there above the normal range or close to the top limit of the normal range, then you should consider that the hypothalamic derangement is causing the altered sense of smell. And we're just beginning to explore that and understand this as an entity, but I think it's a real entity. And I suspect you're going to get a massive shrug. Nope, we can't find anything. Be happy that your MRI is negative response when and if you get the MRI. And if you're worried about the contrast, don't get the contrast. Do an informed refusal. Get the MRI. If you have a large brain tumor that needs to be removed, which is the only thing you really need to prove that you don't have, the MRI alone will do that. And off air, we have a couple of comments. One from Maria Elena, a regular listener in Salinas. Is there a blood test that reveals osteoarthritis? And the answer is, unfortunately, no. We diagnose osteoarthritis by x-rays. It's a structural problem. And while it is an inflammatory disease locally, you can't really use blood markers for inflammation. And this is in contrast to rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or psoriatic arthritis, all of which do tend to have certain blood markers that tell us that that's the problem. something interesting, a world's first, and it does speak to some of the issues of growing organs. So let me tell you about the first artificial trachea. The patient had a tumor at the bottom part of his trachea, that's the windpipe, right where it split into the two main stem bronchioles. And so typically what had to be done for that is a cadaver trachea, because this is obviously a structure that's rather complex, and it's a very difficult surgery. In this case, the actual implant was grown from the patient's own cells. It's sort of interesting. The researchers collaborating between the Karolinska Institute and University College of London used 3D imaging to scan the patient, and then they constructed a glass model of the part of his trachea that was going to be replaced. And then the glass was used to shape an artificial scaffold of biocompatible material. And then this was sent off to the Karolinska Institute, who used stem cells that had been harvested from the adult patient and seeded the scaffolding with it, and they grew it into a functioning trachea, cartilage and all. Then, in a 12-hour surgery, the patient's replacement trachea was put in. And the cool thing about this is that it's a proof of concept for growing this kind of a structure for any size person. So yes, we can do transplants, but you have problems of tissue rejection and the need for suppressive drugs. If it can be done with your own body tissue, those problems go away. And furthermore, you don't have to worry about fitting a too large trachea into a too small body or vice versa. So this is a potential big deal for structures that are relatively simple, such as trachea. And I'm thinking particularly esophagus, which when you have cancer of the esophagus, it's a huge problem for people because we really can't easily operate on the esophagus. It doesn't heal well. It doesn't suture well. And there isn't an easily located replacement tube that we can use for esophageal cancers. I unfortunately had this conversation recently with a patient newly diagnosed with esophageal cancer. And one of the challenges with this disorder is finding a way to keep that individual with an intact lumen from the mouth to the stomach. And it really is a difficult challenge. Work like this could make a big difference, and I'm very seriously hoping to see news that other structures are being grown in this way. Esophagus is just a little bit more complicated because it's a muscular tube that does have movement, but nevertheless, I am optimistic and hopeful and pleased to see this advance. Right now, I'm going to go to another news story. This one in mice, but I think potentially really great for those with congenital deafness. So congenital deafness is when people are born with a flaw in a gene called TMC1. TMC1 is an ion channel. So let's talk a little bit about hearing. We'll do a little science lesson on how your ears work. Deep inside your ears, there's a curved structure called the cochlea. And the cochlea has nerve cells kind of forming a floor. And growing out of these nerve cells are these little filamentous hair cells. At the base of the hair cells, there are ion channels. When the ion channels are opened by movement of the hair cells, it allows salt to flow into the nerve, and that triggers an action potential. So if you have a congenital defect in TMC1, you don't have any ion channels. They've been working with mice, and they discovered this is the cause for hereditary deafness. So this is new information. The mouse researchers, we've confirmed that it's also the same thing in humans. They've now done some work with an adenovirus, and they've managed to engineer a virus to carry normal copies of the TMC1 gene into the hair cells of the mice that had mutations and restore the hearing of the mice. This is hugely important, hugely, hugely important. And I am really excited. I'm a little worried about adenovirus vectors because in previous human studies trying to treat people who have an autoimmune disorder where they don't make any antibodies, the adenovirus did trigger leukemia. And I'm not sure the mice live long enough for us to be able to ascertain that we're not going to do that. So we may have to do human studies, and there could be a bad outcome there. Nevertheless, if it can be shown that it does work and they can find a virus that tends to target hair cells specifically and not go after bone marrow, it could be really good. Now, let's go back to the callers. Maureen in Los Gatos. Hello, Maureen, and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for waiting and calling back. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, I've learned a lot while I was waiting.
Well, that's good. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I am very concerned about one of my sons who is 55 and has had joint pain all of his life. As a teen, I took him to a doctor with swollen knees, and the doctor said he had osteoarthritis. I guess he just assumed he's going to live with this for the rest of his life, and he has done that, and he has the kind of work that involves physical labor. He owns a window washing and custodial business, and he has a lot of joint pain in the summer months when he's working hard, and then in the winter months when he's not working as hard, it tends to calm down a bit. It is getting worse as he ages. He's 55. But he says he's never had a diagnosis as an adult of osteoarthritis or anything else. He just assumes whatever he has is some kind of arthritis, and he takes ibuprofen for it. But then recently, and he's, you know, he takes care of his health. He eats a healthy diet and exercises. He usually runs or walks. Mm-hmm. But in this last year, he's been working with a personal trainer pretty assiduously. He was quite pleased with the work. And then one day he was playing football with some guys, and he got the ball and began to run with it and collapsed. Completely. Mm-hmm. Just fell. His legs didn't work. And I think he went to a physical therapist, I think, who told him that it was he had strained his, what are those muscles behind your thighs?
The hamstrings. Hamstrings.
Hamstrings, yeah. Yes. He had done that. Apparently.
All right, so I'm still waiting for the question. You've done a very good job of setting it up, but I don't know what the question
what
is.
What I would like to know is it possible that that was not osteoarthritis when he had a swollen knee as a teenager, that it was rheumatoid arthritis? Or should he get actual diagnosis in one way or the other? What should he be doing? Because he suffers a lot of pain.
Okay. Well, let's answer the first question. Is it possible that the swollen knees in adolescents were rheumatoid arthritis? Yes, it's possible. But there's also a number of other things like Osgood-Schlatter's and other conditions that could cause a swollen knee. So typically it's an x-ray diagnosis, particularly in adulthood. By now, an x-ray will reveal not only does he have knee osteoarthritis, but how much does he have. And a good clinical knee exam will reveal whether he has any problems with the cartilage and the ligaments, particularly the ligaments. But people in middle age will often sometimes develop cartilage tears abruptly or suddenly, and the knee can collapse. So I'm a little concerned that that's what happened at football. And, you know, you really, if he has bad knees, football's arguably one of the worst possible sports to be engaging in unless you're receiving lots of money for your time because you're burning through your cartilage, and how much are you being paid for that cartilage? And if, you know, obviously it's the twist and turn and the sudden pivots of football that place so much pressure on the knees, plus people are generally wearing shoes that cling to the turf, there's really danger of knee injuries. It's probably the most common football injury. So I don't advise football for him. Walking, swimming, even bicycling are much better forms of exercise that are less likely to injure the knee. So he should get an x-ray, step one, and have it interpreted by a radiologist to see how much damage there is. I think that there's good data that glucosamine sulfate and chondroitin sulfate, now there's data that's come out on that one as well, reduce the speed that a knee degenerates. So yes, it still degenerates over time, but you can slow down that process. Well, obviously that's something you want to do. He has to learn how to work smart. He may need to do more kneeling rather than squatting. When he's doing his window washing business, for example, kneeling on a knee pad rather than squatting to get the lower parts of the window, that's the sort of thing you do as adaptive to hold on to the cartilage and not wear it down any faster than you have to. Physical therapy and knee strengthening exercises, also very important, but they do need to be done, as I said, under direction of a physical therapist so that you don't inadvertently damage the knees. Certain exercises at the gym are a bad idea. The physical therapist can help with advising on that. I like the use of natural anti-inflammatories more than ibuprofen, just because there's a risk of GI bleeding with ibuprofen, particularly if you take it every day for long periods of time. And so I tend to have people using large doses of curcumin.
Curcumin?
Yeah, that's the compound in turmeric. A good brand name is Zyflamend. Brand
name. Can you say that again, that Latin brand name?
Yeah, Zyflamend. And then the other one I'll spell is Meriva. You can find one or the other of those at most health food stores. And also large amounts of fish oil have good anti-inflammatory properties. And I'm talking about maybe 4,000 milligrams of fish oil, which is, for most of them, about 8 capsules. Okay?
One other thing I didn't mention is that now, in addition to joint pain, he also has a lot of muscle pain.
Get him to check a vitamin D level. A lot of people with muscle pain have low vitamin D, and just getting them up to a level of 30 to 35 can make a big difference.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Let's talk to Barbara in Santa Cruz. Hello, Barbara. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Dunn.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for your show. I learn so much each time. I have a question about bunion surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So I have flat feet. I have bunions. The angle is increasing each year. I went into a doctor recently, and we did an x-ray on a foot. The angle is 17 degrees. And he's recommending for that doing the more significant surgery rather than the bunionectomy. I have two questions based on your experience. In your experience, do people with flat feet get bunions come back after bunion surgery?
They can. It really depends on your choice of footwear.
Oh.
People with bunions have to stop wearing heels.
Yes, I don't wear heels.
You've got to be in flats, and you need a wide toe box. So things like Birkenstocks and Earth shoes and stuff like that, because you're actually training your toe to grow in by the shoe.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to stop doing that.
Right.
Post-surgery, it's extremely important. The surgery is very painful, and you will hurt for a long time afterwards. Months.
Okay.
3 to 6 months.
Okay.
So you've got to walk into it being in enough pain that it's worth 3 or 6 months of more pain to get past it. And indeed, when you do get past it, you're pain-free. So that's kind of the trade-off. The flat feet are really, as far as I know, not a great huge risk factor for recurrence of the bunion. I'm not a foot specialist, and I may be wrong about that, but I think that the flat feet have their own set of problems and maybe alter your gait. But as long as you're wearing the wide shoes, I don't think that they contribute to a higher rate of recurrence of the bunion.
Is it okay to be barefooted, like to walk on the sand? That's not a problem.
It's good to be barefooted and walk on the sand.
Okay.
Okay.
And then in addition to the recurrence, what in your experience, even though there's going to be these 3 to 6 months of pain, what in your experience is the time that you can start putting your heel down to put weight on the foot that had surgery, even if you don't put weight on the forefoot?
Oh, people are walking pretty quickly. Week, maybe?
Oh, really?
Yeah, but you're definitely in pain walking, but you're not, you know, and you're using a cane, but you can do touchdown weight bearing by 1 week.
That's good news.
You'll be able to stomp around. You won't be stuck in a wheelchair or anything.
Right. That's great.
And you'll get one of those cute blue placards and get to park close to the store, too.
Oh, that's that's maybe the only benefit.
That's probably the only. No, it's not the only benefit, but it's, you know, it's a spoonful of sugar anyway.
Right.
All right. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Dr. Dunn.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Deirdre in Seaside. Hello, Deirdre. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I am 50 years old, very healthy and active, but over the past 2 years I've been having very heavy and long and unpredictable periods.
50 years old, you said, okay.
Uh-huh. I just had a pelvic ultrasound, and they found that I have 3 fibroids, each about the size of an egg, and I also have 1 cyst on my ovaries. I've been trying to get in to see a gynecologist, but it seems like everyone's pretty booked till about mid-January. So I was wondering, is a hysterectomy kind of the recommended course of action, or are there other options
that
I can consider?
Yeah, let's talk about that. First of all, at 50, I would say that your fertile days are probably behind you.
I would agree.
And so we don't need to worry about preserving the uterus for fertility. In a younger woman, you can carve out the fibroids, and though people who've had those myomectomies usually do well with subsequent pregnancies. That's, you know, a way of preserving fertility, not your issue. Mm-hmm. In general, when a woman is close to menopause, let's suppose your mother went through menopause at 52 and not 55, then we would say, well, it's all going to get a lot better at menopause. So if the woman is not actively anemic, if she can take iron and her bone marrow can keep up with the heavy periods, then it's reasonable to just sort of sit tight. The thing that is otherwise done for heavy periods, an ablation of the endometrium, is much less successful if you have fibroids, because they get in the way of doing a good thorough ablation. An ablation is where typically they go in with either a balloon that they fill with very hot water or a little metal probe that is heated and burn the tissue that normally produces the lining, the endometrial tissue, and essentially create scar. And then if you've got nothing but scar, that doesn't produce lining, so you don't bleed. But it's hard to get around and behind those fibroids. So while ablation can relieve some of the bleeding, it generally doesn't stop all of it if there are fibroids present. So that kind of gives you the options. And of course, hysterectomy is on the table if you don't really want to try to ride it out, or you are anemic. Then at that point, hysterectomy starts to look like a good option. With respect to hysterectomies, I've become an advocate of what's called a partial hysterectomy. In the situation where there's not a cancer, you leave the cervix behind, and that allows you to leave the ligaments that hold the cervix up, so you have more pelvic floor support. And furthermore, there's a plexus of nerves that get amputated when you remove the cervix, and for many women, those nerves are critical for having an orgasm.
Okay,
so you got some options there. Do you know whether or not you're anemic?
I don't think I am.
All right, make sure before you go in to see the GYN, because that's really critical.
Mm-hmm.
And think to yourself about, you know, would I be willing to put up with this for a couple more years? There are also some drug therapies. I mean, they can give you Lupron, which will shut off the stimulation from your pituitary gland. You'll go into an instant total menopause, very unpleasant. And I don't recommend that. That's sometimes done to shrink fibroids, but it's a pretty aggressive strategy.
Yeah.
You may be able to just wait it out and get through menopause, and the bleeding will stop then, most likely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye. I'm going to go to another email. This is from Ed in Springfield, Illinois. I enjoy your show. I'm lucky to have found you. I'm a relatively healthy 37-year-old male on no prescription medication. I've been having a problem with hives for the last 3 months. They are terrible. They're on my trunk, arms, back, but not my face. I was listening to your show and you recommended quercetin and probiotics for someone having an allergic reaction. I tried that for 2 weeks. I'm still using them, and they helped initially. I was able to go without Benadryl for 3 days. Then I got stressed out, and then poof, they were back in force. They also came back when I raked the leaves. I can't pinpoint when I got them first, but I am allergic to strawberries and I accidentally ate some, so that may have been when they started. I changed laundry detergent, soap, shampoo, got rid of the fabric softener, and I'm wondering if my next step should be an elimination diet. Or could my system just be all messed up from the strawberries? If you have any suggestions for what I should do next. Well, since you've had your symptoms, Ed, for 3 months, I think you should go on an elimination diet. And you can email me at the contact us box at askdrdawn.com, and I will send you an appropriate elimination diet for getting rid of the 9 most common food antigens, which include things like corn, soy, and wheat. If we can get your symptoms under control, then we start reintroducing things. I want to give you a little other practical advice. Since you mentioned that the raking of the leaves triggered your hives, that means that the histamine receptors in your skin or the mast cells actually degranulated and released histamine from just physical activity, increased blood flow. So these guys are just primed to burp out histamine whenever they have the least provocation. You can't stabilize the mast cells too easily with drugs because the best drug to do that, chromium sodium, can't get into the bloodstream very easily. It's destroyed in the digestive tract. But you can block the histamine receptors in the skin. You mentioned Benadryl. The other thing that's missing for you is Tagamet, cimetidine. This is used for ulcers. It's over the counter, but about 150 milligrams twice a day of cimetidine or 300 twice a day will block the histamine receptors called the H2 receptors in the skin and seriously reduce your symptoms of the hives. So that plus the H1 receptor blocker Benadryl will get you some symptomatic relief while meanwhile you do your elimination diet and try to eliminate whatever it is that's perpetuating this response. And obviously the strawberries could have been the thing that got it rolling, but it sounds like now you've got more going on and need more help. We're going to finish up with a little bit about Christmas and Christmas presents. I was reading in Popular Science, and this is the December 2011 issue, so it's still online, some really interesting things that I must see as Christmas presents for me as a doctor and also Christmas presents for the developing world. A company called AII has a product called Lab on a Chip. It costs less than a penny to make. You put a drop of blood on it, and it tells you whether the liver enzymes are elevated. Now, all over the developing world, we have perhaps 13 million people worldwide who are using drugs for AIDS or tuberculosis, which can trigger hepatitis. And in the third world, it's very hard to monitor for hepatitis. So having a little instant strep, very similar to those pregnancy test kits or the ovulation test kits, except using blood for elevated liver enzymes is huge. And they've got the cost down to 5 cents a chip. The first shipment went off to India, and that is a Christmas present for the world. Another interesting Christmas present for me as a doctor is better bandages. 3M has just introduced a new kind of tape that is called a non-setting silicone adhesive. So attention all you people out there with tape allergies. You've been reacting to the acrylate in medical tape adhesive. This new tape is more like a post-it note. The tape stays on pretty well, comes off easily, and can be reused and placed back on your body. So 3M has done it again with their adhesive technology. Very, very cool. Another present for the medical world is a product called Recell Spray-On Skin. The kit costs $1,200, but what you can do with this kit is take a small biopsy of the person's skin, grind it up and mix it in with the special growth suspension that comes with this kit. After 20 minutes, the cells have been stimulated to grow and have begun to multiply, and they can be sprayed onto an area that's 80 times the sample size that was taken. So 6 millimeters becomes 480 millimeters. So that's enough to really cover a serious burn. Very cool science. That's called Avita Recell Spray-On Skin. And I'm definitely going to look on that. Now, here's something for all of you who have senior parents that are out there and you're worried about them. There's a Track Everything band. It's a wristband. It looks kind of like the Armstrong wristband. It senses steps, monitors sleep patterns, stores a month of activity data, and uploads to a smartphone. So you can analyze and monitor your parent, their activity, and if you are checking in on them regularly, you can certainly see exactly, are they going to bed? How well are they sleeping? You can make sure that they're doing as well as they say they are, monitoring at a distance. There's also that wonderful pill box that I told you about a few weeks ago, where you can tell whether or not your parent opened up the box and took their medication. Coming down the line, another device using a mass spectroscope. It's a scanner called the Aura. It's a laser. It shoots a laser beam into a skin lesion and measures vibration in the skin molecules. Those vibrations are different when that skin lesion is a melanoma. They're estimating, it's not on the market yet, but the Verisant Aura, when it comes out, they're estimating screening tests will cost about $10 each. And being able to identify a melanoma or a probable melanoma with a non-invasive test, boy, you can bet I'm going to try to acquire that device. Two more cool things. Nowadays, when you have a heart that is going to be transplanted, you keep it on ice and it degrades within just a few hours. A new organ care system keeps hearts bathed in bloods and keeps them pumping. So a heart can be kept usable for 8 hours. The company making this is Transmedics Organ Care System. Those sell for $40,000, but hey, how often do you need a heart transplant? One last one, and that's the Magical MacGyver Kit. This I want the next time I travel. It's a medical erector set. It has all kinds of parts that can be combined and recombined into hundreds of medical devices, including a cauterizer powered by a solar cell and a nebulizer that fits a bicycle pump so that you can give asthma therapy with a bicycle pump. Wow. I know what I want for Christmas, Santa. Did you hear me? Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. And this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.